Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening. Welcome to the London School of Economics and Political Science. My name is David Madden. I'm an associate professor of sociology here at LSE. And as the chair of tonight's event, I'm excited to welcome both our online audience and the audience here in the Sheikh Zayed Theater. Today we're joined by four incisive speakers who are going to talk about the recent election in the U.S., what it means for left politics and left movements in the U.S., in the U.K., and elsewhere. Please note that the event tonight is being recorded, and assuming no technical difficulties, will be made available as a podcast. So for that reason, we'd appreciate if everyone in the audience tonight could silence their phones at this point. The way that this event is going to work is that first we'll hear from our four speakers. After that, I'll ask a few questions, and then we'll take questions from the audience. For those of you who are here in person, we'll let you know when the floor is open for questions. And for the online audience, you'll be able to submit your questions via the Q&A feature at the top left of the screen. So let me introduce our panel tonight. Our first speaker will be Kate Aronoff, who is a Brooklyn-based journalist and staff writer at The New Republic and member of the editorial board of Dissent. Kate is the author of Overheated: How Capitalism Broke the Planet and How We Fight Back, as well as co-author of A Planet to Win: Why We Need a Green New Deal, and co-editor of We Own the Future: Democratic Socialism, American Style. After Kate, we'll hear from Inderjeet Parmar, who is Professor of International Politics at City, University of London, and Honorary Research Fellow in Politics at the University of Manchester, and a graduate of LSE. Among other work, Inderjeet is the author of Foundations of the American Century, the Ford, Carnegie, and Rockefeller Foundations in the Rise of American Power, as well as Special Interests, the State, and the Anglo-American Alliance, 1939 through 1945. Following Inderjeet will be Stephen Castle, who is the London correspondent for The New York Times. Stephen has more than 30 years of experience in journalism. He previously worked as the Brussels bureau chief of the International Herald Tribune and has reported extensively on British politics, Brexit, and international relations. Finally, we'll hear from Richard Seymour, also a graduate of the LSE, who is a Northern Irish writer and editor based in London and a founding editor of Salvage magazine. Richard's writing has appeared in The New York Times, The Guardian, Jacobin, Prospect, and elsewhere. Richard's many books include Against Austerity and, most recently, the timely book that appeared this year, Disaster Nationalism: The Downfall of Liberal Civilization. So I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on these important issues. I obviously don't need to fill anyone in on what happened last week. I think we're all aware. Before we start, I do want to say that this event is part of the Ralph Miliband program, which was set up in 1996 thanks to a generous donation by a former PhD student of Miliband's. And you may know that Ralph Miliband was a Marxist theorist, an ambivalent Labour Party activist, and a sociologist and political scientist whose huge scholarly work included books such as Parliamentary Socialism and The State in Capitalist Society. He was a strident critic of the capitalist state, but also argued that states are not inherently and permanently constrained by the structures of capital. Miliband thought that political institutions are shaped and determined by class struggle. And while states and political parties are currently instruments of the dominant class, in other hands, they could be resources for democratic social transformation. So I think that Miliband's work actually raises a lot of questions that we will need to grapple with tonight, such as what relationship should the left have to liberal parties and state institutions, especially given the rise of reactionary forces. If the major theme of the age is the pervasive experience of crisis that contemporary capitalism generates, why isn't the left more powerful? And What should the left be seeking now? Is it just a matter of pursuing societal harm reduction? Or can we still articulate a vision of a radically different social order? So there's a lot on the table, and I can't wait to hear what our speakers have to say about all this. So I'm very happy now to hand the floor over to Kate Aronoff.
Thank you, everyone, and everyone who helped organize this event.
I'll lean in, as our great philosopher Sheryl Sandberg once told us to do. So I have, in some ways, the easy task tonight, which is that I'm starting. And so this sort of massive question of how does the U.S. left, or how does the left relate to the U.S. presidential election, I can take off the easiest chunk of it and leave the rest to my esteemed co-panelist. So that is exactly what I'll do. And sort of appropriately to start first, I want to start off by just talking a little bit about, I think, what has been on most people's minds, at least in sort of the circles I'm in the U.S., and I'd imagine to some extent on the minds of people here, which is how did this happen, right? And so if the question for tonight is what does the U.S. election mean for the left, and if we extend that to progressives maybe, then let's break that into parts, right? So on the one hand, what does Kamala Harris's loss mean for the left? And on the other, what does Donald Trump's victory and another Trump administration mean for the left? And again, perhaps progressives too. So I'm mostly going to stick to the first part of that, and hopefully we can get into the rest in the rest of these remarks. And I'm sure everyone on the stage will have great things to say about those questions too. So you would think that losing an election as commandingly as Kamala Harris did would be cause for some soul searching on the part of the party that lost that election, namely the Democratic Party. Instead, some of the party's most influential voices have started trying to blame the quote-unquote left, whatever they might mean by that, for their loss. They claim Democrats talk too much about pronouns and about trans rights, that the uncommitted movement, which protested the Biden administration's continued military aid to Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, drove voters in Michigan away from supporting Kamala Harris. They said she wasn't tough enough on immigration. By any reasonable definition, the left had very little to do with the campaign that Kamala Harris ran. Harris promised to build Trump's border wall. She campaigned with Liz Cheney. She championed Dick Cheney's endorsement. She bragged about having overseen record levels of oil and gas production. Rather than substantive policies, she focused mostly on celebrity endorsements, protecting Democratic institutions, and keeping Trump out of the White House again. She did nothing to differentiate herself from Biden's disastrous foreign policy agenda or on any other front. When asked on The View how her administration would be different from Biden's, she said, "I can't think of anything," before clarifying that she would, in fact, add Republicans to her cabinet. The results of that strategy were pretty clear. 90% of counties in the U.S. shifted in favor of Trump, who won all seven swing states. Harris picked up voters who make over $100,000 and lost ground with just about every other reliable Democratic constituency, including young people. 56% of young men in the United States voted for Biden in 2020. In 2024, 56% of them backed Trump. In certain swing states, those figures were even more dramatic. In 2020, Biden won young men in Pennsylvania by 9 points. In 2024, exit polls found that young men in Pennsylvania backed Trump by 18 points. Inflation played a major role in those results. Still, inflation isn't some wave that crashes over the economy. Home prices have risen 45% over the last 4 years. Nearly half of U.S. renters pay more than 30% of their income on their housing. Home insurance is becoming rapidly unaffordable in large parts of the country or unavailable altogether. That's especially true in places that have been hit by floods, fires, and hurricanes that climate change is making worse. The trouble with pretending that inflation is one big problem is that it imagines one big solution, which is raising interest rates. The Fed did, in fact, raise interest rates during the Biden administration, and in doing so, put mortgages and car ownership even further out of reach. That also further squeezed the tens of millions of Americans who are burdened with credit card, student, and medical debt. But from a left perspective, the fact that economic concerns played such a major role in this election is a complicated one. That's because the economics is the area where the left made some of the biggest inroads, at least sort of on the face of things. Early on, White House officials rejected the advice of deficit hawks like Larry Summers and even vowed a break with free market ideology. Some even embraced the mantle of being post-neoliberal, quote-unquote, members of the administration started sounding more like heterodox economists than Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. Take one typical quote from former National Economic Council head Brian Deese, who advised the Harris campaign. When he was asked about the White House's investment agenda, he said, quote, markets on their own will not make investments in technologies and an infrastructure that benefit an entire industry. We know that when the benefits of innovation are broadly shared, no one firm has incentive to invest in the kind of game-changing technologies or kind of connecting infrastructure that fosters long-term economic competitiveness, which sounds like a heterodox economist. The administration's trademark achievement, the Inflation Reduction Act, arguably would not have happened if it weren't for the movement for a Green New Deal. The Democratic Party hadn't seriously thought about trying to pass climate policies since its fight to enact a national carbon pricing scheme imploded a decade earlier. That a group of kids in the Sunrise Movement and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, along as part of a sit-in, said that investing in climate mitigation and adaptation would create millions of jobs was something for a godsend for a party that had not had any sort of forward-looking vision for well over a decade. Once Biden won the Democratic Party primary in 2020, his team shrunk down the Green New Deal into the American Jobs Plan that he presented in shortly after taking office in 2021. Then Congress shrunk that down even smaller into a package called Build Back Better. And finally, a few lawmakers led by West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, with the help of ExxonMobil, shrunk that down into the Inflation Reduction Act. It is very good that that passed. The $370 billion, give or take, of investments in low-carbon energy technologies will help the United States decarbonize, particularly in the power sector. It's spurred action in Europe as well and in other economies. But the process of whittling down the Green New Deal also shaved off the part of it that might have made the most immediate difference in people's lives. Investments in healthcare and childcare, broad, universal programs that would create jobs, bringing down energy bills, and jobs for young people around the country doing vital conservation work. Instead, two-thirds of the Inflation Reduction Act's funds flow toward corporations, mostly in the form of generous tax breaks for manufacturing investments to make things like electric vehicles and wind turbines. Consumer-side subsidies to buy electric vehicles and to put solar panels on your house still mostly benefit higher-income households who can afford the still expensive upfront cost of purchasing those things. So as the price of everything from milk to rent and car payments goes up, the fact that an electric vehicle battery factory is being built hundreds of miles away doesn't offer much relief. Neither do the sort of abstract economic statistics that the White House liked to point to. Manufacturing, construction spending, even low unemployment, a remarkable achievement in its own right, like many other things the Biden administration did on the economy, but not one that is of much solace to people who are struggling to pay their bills. At least part of the reason Bidenomics didn't manage to connect with voters is that improving the lives of ordinary people, let alone reducing carbon emissions, was not its main goal. As, like Brian Deese, the State Department's Jake Sullivan, and a number of other administration officials explained, the goal of investing in things like clean energy and semiconductors and chips was to allow the United States to dominate the 21st century's most important export industries. In keeping with that, Biden imposed 100% tariffs on Chinese cars and extended Trump's tariffs on other goods from China, all the while encouraging the EU to adopt similar policies. In recent months, Deese outlined a clean energy Marshall Plan premised on building new markets for U.S.-made green tech in developing countries and, quote, crafting a global coalition to retaliate against a flood of Chinese exports. That plan, he said, would allow the U.S. to invest in its own manufacturing capacity, quote, while winning greater influence in this new geopolitical landscape. As Secretary of State Antony Blinken explained in Foreign Affairs, America's strategic fitness rests in large measure on its economic competitiveness. So to summarize, what began as a transformative agenda to confront the climate crisis and economic inequality all at once has been mutated over the course of 4 years into a program to protect and cement U.S. economic hegemony, with so-called post-neoliberals leading the charge. So where does this leave the left and progressives? I'll speak to the tiny portion of those groups that I know best, which are those who work on climate change. So on the one hand, the movement for a Green New Deal provided a new framework, a genuinely exciting, transformative way to think not just about climate politics, but economic policy making more generally. Importantly, that also happened during the Trump administration. Still, one major lesson of the last 4 years is that if you live in an empire, that empire is liable to cannibalize anything good. I'd argue that coming up with plans on the scale of a Green New Deal is a better use of time than trying to react to every new awful thing the Trump administration does. Those plans should take the results of this election seriously, to focus on improving ordinary people's lives through investments in housing and transportation. Whether or not the Democratic Party will be receptive to that is another matter. We also know that ideas aren't good enough. It wasn't a couple of well-placed policy wonks who put climate policy onto the national agenda a couple of years back. That happened thanks to more than a decade of organizing against pipelines and fossil fuel infrastructure around the country, the Sunrise Movement sitting in at Nancy Pelosi's office, the people who door-knocked and phone-banked for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, and the people who ran for office, in some cases as Democratic Socialists, after working on and being inspired by that campaign. So I'm sure we'll get into the complications of all this, but on this first go, I'll say that my answer to what this means for the left is a pretty boring one for a socialist, right? It's that we should invest in the sorts of institutions for working class power that allow working class people to exercise power in a political system like the United States, to pay militant attention to internationalism, and to not let that be siloed off from climate or any other sort of field of interest, and to focus on making the ideas that confront the problems at the scale that they need to be confronted, which is a little bit of a cop-out on my end, but I hope we get into the details as the panel goes on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think, Kate, I agree with everything you just said. I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm really honoured to speak at a Ralph Miliband forum event. When I was a student here, he had already left this university, but The State and Capitalist Society was one of the books which I found most inspiring, and I've been forcing most of my students to read it ever since. And I reread it in preparation for this, and I also looked at his Divided Societies from the 1988-89 as well. And I think a lot of my remarks, in fact, are drawn in a way from some of the theoretical frameworks that he advanced at that time. I'm going to make some specific remarks about the Democratic Party, but they're rooted in, or they're framed within, a kind of an understanding about the relationship between liberalism and democracy, liberalism and capitalism, liberalism and the far right, but also liberalism within the context of a liberal international order as well. And so it's within that context that the Democratic Party, to me, makes some kind of sense. And I think my critique of it is probably a little bit more thoroughgoing than what you've spoken about. What I would say is that the Democratic Party claims to be a kind of broadly centrist, centre-left party, but it's also surrounded by an ecosystem of more left-type groups as well, or more left-liberal groupings. Some of them are openly political and within the Democratic Party or within the fringes of it. So you've got the Squad, you've got the Democratic Socialists of America, and many magazines and newspapers, broadcasters. You even got foundations like Hewlett, who talk a lot about post-neoliberalism, and many of them are recruited into the Biden administration and kind of help to sort of push so-called Biden economics and so on. And I've done a little bit of work on the Hewlett Foundation's programs for a research article more recently. So that is to say, the Democratic Party is not a party alone. It exists within this kind of ecosystem. But it also exists within it a very strong relationship with the Republican Party as well, always promoting a strong Republican Party. So even in the wake of 6th of January 2021, President Biden called for a strong Republican Party with which he was going to work in a bipartisan way and so on. At a pragmatic level, one can understand that, but on the other hand, the Republican Party is a far-right party. Those who study conservatism anywhere in the world compare it to a far-right European party. The only problem is, of course, or the greater problem is, that in European countries there are a number of these multi-party systems. In the United States, there's only the two main political parties. So in effect, you've got one half of the party system which refuses to accept the outcome of elections unless it happens to be on the winning side. And it is to that party and to the candidate who led the charge, in effect, on 6 January 2021, that President Biden and Kamala Harris has now said, just a few days ago, that they're going to make sure that there's a peaceful transfer of power. The principal threat to the peaceful transfer of power is the person to whom they're now speaking about a peaceful transfer of power, and his language has not moderated one bit. And when we look at the kind of a news which is dribbling out about who he's going to have a border czar and someone to sort of destroy government and that kind of thing, we can begin to see that his program is going to be, in fact, they denied Project 2025 had anything to do with Donald Trump, and since the victory last week, they've begun to sort of recognize how significant it's going to be in the administration. So the nature of the Democratic Party, to my mind, is one of the most fundamental sort of things in my mind to understand. And I would make three very bold, fairly crude-sounding points that I would argue are problematic about the Democratic Party. The first one, it is a party of war. The second, it is a party of identity politics. And the third, it is a party of class struggle from above. The first one, that is that, generally speaking, the Democrats have this image of being the party that promotes democracy, that is sort of broadly liberal and kind of peace-oriented. They're the good people. They do some good wars, but generally speaking, they prefer to avoid wars. But actually, the Democratic Party is the party of war. World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, up until the Gulf War of 1990-something, it was largely the party of war. So then when you look at the congressional makeup of the party itself, more and more in the last several years, more and more of their representatives, for example, have been drawn from the military, ex-military people, ex-CIA and other intelligence, and so on. That is to say, the party in Congress itself has become more and more kind of linked with the military and other intelligence agencies and things like that. So in effect, what you've got is a party which is much closer. In fact, I would argue that with the drift of the Republican Party towards some sort of realism or vital interest-driven kind of a strategy, the Democratic Party has become the party which even former Republican appointees to the military apparatus and so on tend to look as more reliable in regard to continuing the United States role in what are called forever wars itself. So I would say that one of the key problems in this particular election has been the fact that over the last several years, opposition to forever wars has grown to a very, very great extent across both political parties' supporters. But the Democratic Party has not honoured that particular kind of a tendency and paid enough attention to it, and has paid a very big price. But I don't think that's necessarily a tactical problem for the party. It is a party of the state, and it is the party of warfare. So those who drive voters into the Democratic Party's election booths and so on are actually handing them over to a party which is structurally so attached to the state and to warfare that it is it actually, in a way, it's a way of channeling that support. The second thing I would say is about identity politics. And I would argue that both political parties play the game of identity politics, and that is a politics of divide and rule, which has operated particularly since the 1970s in the wake of the civil rights movement and so on, across a number of different features, including women's rights and so on and so forth. And I would argue that that, in effect, has promoted a kind of a sort of divide and rule sort of politics, which has ignored the kind of working class interests and so on, which I think the Democratic Party suffered from in last week's election. The last thing I would say is it's a party of class struggle from above. It is so attached to big money. I mean, when you just count up the billionaires behind Trump and behind Kamala Harris, there are more billionaires behind Kamala Harris than there were behind Donald Trump. And they're just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the millions and billions of dollars which flow into the two main political parties. And that is, in effect, to say that there is no mention of the ordinary people who are paying high food prices, high gas prices, healthcare problems, housing problems, problems of indebtedness and so on, greater levels of inequality, falling wage levels and so on. Whereas actually most of the focus is really around big level economics, that is, or the GDP, or this many millions of jobs, or 700,000 manufacturing jobs and so on. When it's actually ordinary people are suffering from many, many different other things and so on, I would say that that has played a major role in the defeat as well. So what I would argue is that the people who are kind of a little bit further to the left of the mainstream of the Democratic Party, with whom I agree on many different questions, they tend to play the role of hoovering up dissent and dissenting voices and leading them into the polling booths behind this particular party, which structurally is so wedded to the state and to warfare that I would argue that it is not likely to be a vehicle for any kind of radical change anytime soon. And as Kate said, their idea about post-neoliberalism is such a sort of superficial change to the dominant kind of ideology we've had at least for the last 40 years or so that is unlikely to do very much for working class and middle class people in the United States or anywhere else. Okay, I'll stop there. All right.
It's me. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. And thank you for attending. As you can probably hear from my accent, although I work for the New York Times, I have an American passport. I was actually raised in Britain. I've been working here and in continental Europe for most of my career, so I'm going to focus mainly on the left or the centre-left in Europe and in Britain, in particular the Labour government. And I've come up with about five takeaways, I think, from the elections, which I'd like to explain to you. And I think for the Labour government, the election of Donald Trump was a setback. But I don't think it was a surprise at all. I can remember talking to one of Starmer's key aides last December, and while he was talking about some of the problems that an incoming Labour government would face, he added at the end, and to add to it all, if we are elected, we might be dealing with Donald Trump. And hence, we've seen a pretty concerted effort by Labour figures, particularly David Lammy, even before he became Foreign Secretary, to make his way into Trump world. That culminated with the dinner between Donald Trump and Keir Starmer in Trump Tower in September, which apparently we're told went pretty well. So it won't have come as a big surprise to the government. And I think the first takeaway that they will conclude from this election is, it's a pretty obvious one, it's that the economy is crucial. Because Trump's campaign pointedly asked the question that I think Ronald Reagan first asked in 1980, which is, do you, the American voters, do you feel better than you did 4 years ago? And they came back with a pretty resounding, no, they don't. So that means that the focus, particularly for this government in Britain, is going to be on trying to raise living standards, and to revive public services, and that involves stimulating economic growth, because it's only through the economic growth that you get the revenue in order to invest in your schools and your hospitals. The paradox, of course, is that Trump makes that more difficult. There are a couple of factors there. One is tariffs, apparently one of Donald Trump's favourite words. If there is a trade war between Europe and the United States, or a global trade war, that obviously could have pretty dire consequences economically, even if it's a rather more limited imposition of tariffs, which is more likely. There's a threat that if Britain responds, as the EU will almost certainly, that will push up inflation, keep interest rates high, and therefore impede the government's growth agenda. That's the first one. The second one, of course, is that Donald Trump wants to reduce spending on support for Ukraine, and that implies that Europe, and including the United Kingdom, will have to increase defence spending. There's a vague pledge to increase defence spending to 2.5% of GDP, but I think I'll have to go into a bit more detail about that soon. But more money for defence means less money for your public services. So the economy is the first one. The second, I think that the government will take away from this is that it'll redouble their need, the desire to reset relations with the European Union and to get that reset right. On security and defence, clearly Europe is going to have to do more as the US starts to withdraw more from Europe, withdraw spending, reduce spending. That means that cooperation in Europe is absolutely crucial among European allies. Britain has sort of already started with a defence treaty with Germany, which was signed quite recently. There's going to be negotiations on a defence and security pact with the EU. So that looks relatively smooth. On the economy, it's a bit less clear exactly what the UK wants there. It's going to be slightly harder on the economy to cozy up to the European Union without annoying Donald Trump, potentially, particularly if there's some sort of tariff war. So I think there the key for Britain is really to decide what it wants from the European Union and pursue that quite aggressively. But at the moment, those objectives don't appear to have been defined. The third takeaway, I would say, is to have a strategy for dealing with populism without compromising on principles, but there's no doubt that Trump's victory will embolden populists around Europe, Viktor Orban in Hungary, and Nigel Farage's Reform Party here. Even without a victory for Trump, Nigel Farage's party couldn't really be ignored, I don't think, for the Labour Party. When you consider what happened at the last election, it won 14% of the vote, and it finished second in 89 seats where the Labour Party won. So it's clearly a threat. Farage is very clearly identifying as his target voters those people who voted for Brexit, had once been Labour voters, voted for Brexit, voted for Boris Johnson, then went back to Labour at the last election. So the government's got to keep an eye on the policies he raises. The two I think he will raise, obviously, immigration. There, it's a sensitive issue, obviously, for the government, because if you cut immigration too much, immigration is good for your economic growth. But this government and the previous government had decided that immigration, which had trebled since Brexit, had gone to, and in terms of net migration, had got to too high a level. The good news from this government's point of view is that it's coming down anyway, and that's legal net migration. On the other issue on migration, of course, is the arrival of people on small boats, more difficult for the government to tackle, but I think that again points back to a reset with the European Union and perhaps a migration pact with the European Union, which is much more far-reaching than what's envisaged at the moment. The other issue of which Farage will raise is net zero. Again, the government's very committed to climate change policy, and we wouldn't want to change that, but it's just got to be sensitive to potential changes that load costs onto individual groups. And I think the warning there was Germany, where the issue over heat pumps caused a big backlash. And if you talk actually to people like Ed Miliband, son of Ralph Miliband, I mean, his argument is that the costs of the transition have to be socialised. I think that's absolutely right, but they have to be sensitive, because that's an area where Farage would also be complaining. Fourth lesson is that candidates matter. The Democrats didn't manage to hit on a winning candidate in the US. As we know, they had a difficult situation, the Biden transition, but I think that is a warning to European left-wing European countries, parties in European countries, particularly in Germany. If you look over into the German political situation at the moment, the coalition there has collapsed. We're likely to see elections early next year. The German SPD actually does have an incredibly popular leader in Boris Pistorius. Unfortunately, he's not the chancellor candidate, so maybe a bit more ruthlessness would work there. The final lesson I'd say is that the political narrative is critical. Controlling the political narrative is critical, and it's important to have a degree of urgency for implementing your policies. I think Kate mentioned the Inflation Reduction Act. I think I'm right in saying that has produced employment, but correct me if I'm wrong, but the lead time has been long. So it takes a long time for these policies to generate the economic growth that you want. And in Labour's perspective, you know, it's got to get on with its agenda of promoting economic growth. In its case, that's planning reform, possibly a reset with the EU, but it's got to make progress next year, I think, if it's going to have any impact in time for the next general election. And there's a sort of broader point there, because Labour's ideas for stimulating growth, creating an industrial policy, reviving public services, they're very different from Donald Trump's tax-cutting agenda. Those differences are going to be increasingly stark over the next few years. And Labour really needs to show that its strategy can work. Even though it was only elected in July, I'd say time is pretty short.
I want to focus on the responses and analyses and debates, because with wearisome inevitability, the lumpen commentary returns to its own stale sick. And after this election, what did we get? We got the endless debates about, well, it's the whiteness. No, it's the economic anxiety. It's masculinity. It's non-college. It's the white working class. Or it's just who we are. That's a parochial non-debate reflecting the fact that American pundits, present company accepted, do not think much about the rest of the world. Trump has expanded his electoral base in every election since 2016, and that is not an aberration. You could look at Modi, look at Marcos and then Duterte, look at Orban in Hungary, look at the Israeli coalition of Likudniks and assorted fascists, look at Bolsonaro. He won more votes when he lost than when he won the election. And that's a pattern. Look at Jose Cast in Chile, look at Geert Wilders' party in the Netherlands, Marine Le Pen keeps raising her share of the vote, Front National is close to national power, Alternative for Deutschland is now second largest party, etc., etc., etc. There are oscillations in this general pattern of ascent for the far right, and sometimes the big picture obscures some important little details, such as, for example, in Italy, the sort of vote share doesn't necessarily reflect the character of the far-right vote that you're getting. From Lega Nord to Brothers of Italy, you're moving towards a more overt relationship with fascist heritage. Nor are electoral outcomes the only indicator here. I mean, globally, we've seen a syncopated rhythm of lone wolf massacres, racist riots, vigilante murders, pogroms from Delhi to the West Bank, and they are all part of the same contagion. As Kate mentioned, Trump has expanded into new areas of the Rainbow Coalition. This time exit polls say he expanded among new voters, young voters, black voters, Latino voters, Arab American voters, voters earning under 100,000. In the city of Passaic, New Jersey, 3/4 of the population is Hispanic, give huge popular majorities to Obama, Clinton, and Biden, swung behind Trump this time. Look to deep blue New York City. In 2020, Biden won with 53% majority. Harris's margin is down to 38%. Financial Times, they drill down to the Bronx, where the Democrat lead was cut by 10% as primarily Muslim and Latino voters rejected Harris. Some because of Gaza, because genocide is a thing, some people it's a red line for them, irrationally, unspeakably, can't explain it. A substantial number of Hispanic voters see illegal immigration as threatening to them. The social demographic changes, therefore, that were supposed to be building inexorably towards democratic hegemony are revealing other potentialities. And that, too, would not be surprising if one paid attention to the trends abroad. In India, for example, the BJP has expanded its base into poor and historically excluded populations such as the Dalits. Corey Robin recently pointed out that this really is a version of the old question, how conservatives build support for domination among the dominated. There's no single shibboleth that's going to explain this, but it really oughtn't to be as shocking as it is. Take, for example, those younger American voters, the young men. About half of young men aged 18 to 29 years old voted for Trump. Big turn to the right among Generation Z men. Why is that happening? I mean, some of this can be tracked to the role of reactionary male influencers like Andrew Tate, Jordan Peterson. If you listen to their victory cry, though, it gives you a hint of something. On the social industry platforms, they're saying, quite ubiquitously, it pops up everywhere, your body, our choice, forever. What's that about, that pathetic, hateful mantra? But a bid for a paltry share in mastery. What does it express in its triumphalist misogyny other than a sheer lack of efficacy and paralysis that people feel in their lives, for which male entitlement and privilege are dangerous pseudo-solutions? It's not untypical of the way the far-right caters to these pervasive feelings. The shock rhetorical strategies of the far-right are deliberately designed to erode legalistic constraints on majoritarian violence. So where the neoliberal centre expects us to be passive and to internalise our aggression and stay out of politics, so that what really happens is that our aggression registers internally as depression, self-loathing, self-medication, self-destruction, the far-right permits, incites and channels public aggression. That is their distinctive offer. That's why every time there's an outburst of violence, pogromism or whatever, it's not demoralising to them, it's not discrediting, it doesn't cause them problems. It's their unique selling point. It energizes them. Much of the argument will linger on the economy, quite rightly so. Inflation was the biggest factor motivating Trump voters. Just want to make a few points about this. I think, obviously, inflation affects different demographics differently. Economic issues always do. And we should, you know, engage in a kind of class analysis of this. It'd be interesting to look at why Trump's biggest gains were among those earning between $30,000 and $50,000 a year. I expect that's because those are the people who are most affected by the disproportionately high rise in fuel prices and food prices. Obvious question, though, why would anyone turn to Trump to solve their economic miseries? Aside from his vacuous sales patter asserting that inflation will vanish completely under his watch, what reason does he give anyone not rich for thinking that he will make their lives better? Inflation currently is 2.4%, so unless he's promising a deflationary course, his promise makes little sense. Secondly, his policies are inflationary. His main policies, massive tariffs and massive deportations, basically make a principle of supply shocks, in addition to being deliberately sadistic, of course. The only way to make sense of this is to infer that American voters know perfectly well that Trump will not achieve his stated goals. Policy is not the point.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
What is the point then? What do we talk about when we talk about the economy? Not the metrics of aggregate well-being. No one believed those figures in America, you know, GDP and all the rest of it, apart from gullible liberals banging on about the vibe session. Not perceptions of personal well-being. People don't vote like consumers. Most of the time, partly thanks to decades of neoliberal culture, personal difficulties are experienced not as political but as individual failure. That is exactly why, as Oscar Wilde said, agitators are so absolutely necessary. We aren't always aware that we should be outraged by our situation. We're only likely to politicize our privations if we see them as part of a general social crisis, and then it becomes abundantly clear that the economy is a moral and civilizational space structured by all the experiences of competition, cooperation, exploitation, resentment, vague expectancy, and sometimes, occasionally, solidarity. An economic experience, far from feeding mechanically into a logical political expression, is always mediated by politics and ideology, and of course the emotional substratum of life. So when economic privations, shocks, and stresses are politicized, it's often sad passions prompted by those experiences, as well as the nameless personal miseries with which they tend to congeal and be allied, that are expressed. And there's no single way in which the economy mattered for all of Trump's voters. There would presumably be a considerable difference between those who regularly vote Republican anyway, which would be disproportionately the established middle class in America, those who specifically vote for Trump, which would include a big chunk of Rust Belt working class voters, but not just them, and those whose vote expressed an inchoate rejection of the Democrats. Economic anxiety is a pabulum that doesn't explain anything. It's what needs to be explained. Further, the question will often be not only how my problems are to be resolved, but who's to be punished? Who's going to be made to feel the pain for this? The answer partly depends on how the problem is phrased. Is it out-of-control immigration, where the operative word is control, eroding the quality of our life? Or is it the billionaire class sucking the wealth out of communities? I say resentment is a bad place to get stuck, but it's unavoidable, and it's not necessarily an invalid moral emotion. The question is, what is the alternative to a politics of revenge? How is resentment to be sublimated into a more impersonal and less reactive form of politics? Let us say class politics, let us say hatred for the system, rather than for individuals. In Lacanian terms, we would describe this as a shift from the imaginary register rivalry and aggressivity to the symbolic register of the social compact. What's involved there? This is often the task of political organizing, meeting people where they are, giving them something practical to do about their problem, and educating their desire toward a horizon where revenge would offer no satisfaction. And this is the point I want to finish on. Bernie Sanders criticizes the Democrats today for failing to address bread and butter issues like the minimum wage. Now, he's 100% right on this, but he's not right enough. Bread and butter is important, and Harris' campaign shows that you can't persuasively sing about joy if all you're asking is that people be ecstatic about their current difficult situations. But bread and butter doesn't explain the excitement generated by his primary campaigns and how exciting that was. Because did he just say, we are going to lower health care costs and raise wages? Not a bit of it. He asked people to join him in what he called a political revolution, a revolution that would not only address privation, of course it would, but roll back border statism, dismantle jails, contain militarism, deepen democracy, and raise expectations. He offered people the adventure of achieving something hugely improbable together, of transforming the country. His characteristic phrase, after all, was, if we stand together. That moment passed, but it turns out, my point here, that resentment is not the only politically relevant emotion. People want, remarkably, to come together. People hanker for that social eros, that striving towards one another, that social longing that, as Kropotkin discerned, is a ubiquitous characteristic of life as such, and that is indeed the very meaning of the term libido. The right offers the placebo of national, ethnic, or religious narcissism. We come together on someone else's back and stamp hard. And such yearnings, I keep saying, are indeed pervasive because class societies ooze resentment from every pore. But I finish on the point that there is another and more original striving, one that is muted and obtunded in the shattered and gnomic existences of late capitalism, one that is expressed in fugitive desires for a vaguely better society that erupt from time to time in little ruptures, one that actually frightened Freud, as he assumed in his impeccably bourgeois way that it must always make someone a scapegoat, one that has indeed found various perverse and destructive outcomes, yet persists and is present in every decent accomplishment of the human race, from abolition to democracy, and that is the hunger that lurks even in the shriveled soul of the academic pedant, no offence, the appetite that forms a little Marx and a little Bakunin in every human soul, and I'm just going to go ahead and call it communism. Thank you very much.
you very much to all of you. These are all extremely interesting comments. I actually have a question for every one of you, and maybe we'll go in reverse order of speaking, and then we can open things up for the audience. Richard, I mean, do you really think it really is as straightforward as a credible candidate running on a genuine left populist program would have won the election and would be able to pull together a transformative movement in the US these days?
No, the candidate doesn't create the movement creates the candidate. Look, what happened in 2020 was that the Democrats profited from Black Lives Matter and actually the energy created by the Sanders campaign. It energized people, and that flowed into Biden's standing. And, you know, because he could say, you know, he could move to the left of the traditional Democratic position while remaining quite respectable. He said, I'm the guy who rejected socialism. I won. And they could have a certain appropriation of the energies of Black Lives Matter. The main thing happening in 2024 on the sort of extra democratic left in the streets was Palestine. Democrats didn't want to have anything to do with that. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with that. That was the sort of thing for which, mainly it was the target for various lone wolf and vigilante attacks, as I'm sure you know. So it was dividing and demoralizing. It was a very different situation. So what I would say is if Bernie Sanders had been the candidate miraculously, and he didn't even bother to indicate interest, as far as I know, I think he would have been, at any rate, discredited with a substantial chunk of the base because of his lethargy in coming out in opposition to the war on Gaza. I think that was damaging on the left, but I think in terms of the wider public, he would have been able to energize quite a lot of people. He's a very good communicator. He's still very, very popular in American politics, and that's quite an unusual thing, to have a politician who's actually popular with people. I think I don't think it's just enough just to have a good left populist program, however you define it, and a good candidate. I think the conjuncture matters a lot, and there are conjunctural limitations. That said, I watched this campaign. Trump was boring. You know, I'm familiar with Trump's libidinal excitements, his high points. You know, he always comes up with something. He told Hillary Clinton she was going to jail. People loved that. He had nothing like that this time. No coherent line of attack. He didn't have... the only thing he said that was interesting about Kamala Harris is that she was beautiful, like an actress. He was obviously half in love with her. That's why he lost the debate. Right? So... I think the problem wasn't that Donald Trump was, you know, it has this overweening magnetism and power. I certainly think reaction is a sort of has a momentum at the moment and a global momentum, and it's rooted in the real disasters in people's lives and how they respond to that. But I think in 2024 it was possible to beat Donald Trump, but I'm not going to claim that it would have been, you know, like simple if somebody like Sanders had been running.
Thank you. Stephen, I was listening to what you were saying about the Labour Party, and I'm wondering how confident you are that it's just a matter of sort of learning lessons and they'll be able to sort of navigate these difficult few years. I mean, lots of centre-left parties across Europe have fallen apart. And I think a lot of the structural contradictions that Labour are facing here are quite similar to the US Democrats. How do you think they're going to sort of navigate this situation and not go the way of centre-left parties in many other places?
I mean, I think if you compare the two elections in the US and in the UK, I mean, one of the similarities is that they were very strong anti-incumbency votes. And the problem the Labour Party is going to have in 2028 is, or 2029, is that it will be the incumbent. And that's why, as I said, it's really vital for it to actually get on with its programme. It's got to sort of, you know, I mean, the difficulty for the Labour Party, this government, if you think about that election victory. I mean, it was a landslide election victory. It was achieved with 34% of the vote. So its problems are quite formidable. If you consider what normally happens to governments in midterm, they usually lose about 10-15% of their vote. If you start out like Tony Blair did with 43% of the vote when he won in 1997, even Boris Johnson won with about 43% of the vote, and you lose 10%, well, it's kind of okay, it's recoverable. This government, if it loses 15% of the vote, will be under 20%. It's already under 30%. So it's a sort of lost control of the narrative in the early months. Its budget at least gave a signpost forward. But that's why I would say it's absolutely critical that it really gets on with these, with its economic plan. Because if it doesn't make progress on its EU reset next year, it's not going to do that, really, because we're getting into a pre-election period. If it doesn't make progress on planning reform, it'll just be too late. So it's critical that it actually gets on, that it listens to that voter group who are still suffering from the cost of living crisis, and that it tries to fashion a narrative that explains how it is improving life for people who've had a really quite a difficult time in the last few years.
Great. Indrajit, I think a lot of people here share your critique of the Democratic Party and agree with you and the problems that you identify, but I'm wondering where that leaves us. I'm just to return for a second to Ralph Miliband. In parliamentary socialism, he's basically making precisely the same argument you're making, that Labour is incapable of ever being a transformative vehicle. It's going to try to protect and maintain the system. But he went to the Labour convention. He was active within Labour, and it was partly because he saw it as so restrictive that he wanted to participate in it from a radically critical perspective. Do you think that something similar is required of the Democrats, that extra-parliamentary social movements really need to think about the sort of relationship between movements and the party, and it can't be a matter of just saying the Democratic Party is irrelevant, because it is... I mean, we've seen third parties don't really go anywhere in the U.S., and it is one of the major institutions in the U.S. political system. So how do you think we should respond?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It is something which I've been trying to kind of grapple with as well, because the last thing one wants to do, who sees injustice anywhere, is just a kind of message of doom and gloom, and that's the way it is going to be. And I think I would pick up something Richard said, that actually... In the end, the Democratic political party responds in significant ways to mass movements of protest, and it historically, generally speaking, has been pushed further to take up more kind of left type positions. So you go back to the 1890s and populism, from that emerges a kind of progressivism. You go back to the great sort of the New Deal and the Great Depression and the uprisings of workers and so on, and the organisation of AFL-CIO and that kind of thing. You get the New Deal. Obviously, you have the Communist Party is very much stronger as well. Then in the 1960s, 50s, 60s, you have the Great Society. And then you talk about Black Lives Matter and other kinds of movements which push. So that is to say that inevitably, people facing issues and problems of injustice, of economic, racial, gender, or any other, are going to fight eventually one way or another. But I think the biggest problem arises is that there is no one then single voice which is electorally powerful enough to be able to represent that. And that gets hoovered into the Democratic Party, which kind of has this sort of deadly embrace, which the Republicans kind of do too, which is to say, come, shape-shifting, you get a little faction in, and in effect, you kind of defang them as well. I don't have a particular answer to your question, which is that can there be a kind of really revolutionary democratic movement? But I guess the only thing I would probably suggest is that those movements, which are so inspired by injustice to fight and to people to risk their lives against massive amounts of police violence and repression and so on, retain a degree of vigilance even though democratic spokespeople come forward and say, we are yours, we will then take this into the party. So with BLM, for example, which was much wider than just BLM, Democrats in government, in local government and so on, put forward programs to cut police spending on the police by about $1 billion. So they kind of leaned in, and then they leaned back out again when public opinion and other things kind of calmed down or changed. So I think, in effect, it suggests vigilance on the part of people who protest against injustices, and to sort of carry that on and not rely on the Democratic Party to lead them into the electoral channel, but to kind of be vigilant about them throughout. And maybe then you might have a chance for independent representations and so on. But the problem is that the amount of money involved in American electoral politics, I think once accounting is done for this election, it'll probably be around $10 billion. It is just an insane amount, and that means basically candidates go to people with money. People with money are investing in candidates and parties, and then they expect a return on that investment. And that constitutes a massive influence on candidates and parties, which is very, very difficult to resist. So Alvin Gordon a long time ago said, the way there's an iron law of oligarchy, there's an iron law of democracy. So I think there's a kind of constant struggle between those kinds of positions, with the Democratic Party and the Republican Party via kind of parties of oligarchy. But I think your average person who gets a $400 bill out of, in a surprise bill, goes into debt and financial crisis. I mean, that's the level at which people are kind of having to live. And so that's going to create a massive amount of resistance. And the big thing now is, of course, that with the Trump administration, I think we're going to see a massive upsurge, even greater upsurge, of popular discontent in a variety of ways, which is going to have a very, very large effect on their ability to carry out quite a lot of those sort of policies. But relying on the Democratic Party to resist Trump when they're basically promising... I mean, what did Biden actually say in that speech last week? He didn't say a single thing about protecting people from what is basically going to be the kindest way you can put it is an authoritarian far-right party, under whom they were calling fascist a week earlier. Nothing about protecting people from what is coming. The only thing he said was, we're going to guarantee that Ukraine continues to get the military aid. So he's going to protect the Ukrainian people, but his own people, peaceful transfer of power to what is the most right-wing government probably, that the United States ever had.
So, and finally, Kate, I was struck by what you said. You ended saying you thought it was a bit of a cop-out, because I agree with you that it's sort of easy for those of us on the left to look at this election result and look at just the state of the U.S. and say, look what the centrists did to this place. And I worry that maybe that's a bit too easy. So what do you think we on the left have been wrong about? And when, what do you think we on the left need to rethink, or that we're not seeing in this current situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one tough thing just about trying to understand this election, is I don't see some, abundance of silver linings. Like, in 2016, Bernie had just won. There was this pretty new political movement that seemed to have, captured a lot of the energies from social movements from the last couple of years. It seemed like the left was ascendant in a certain way. It doesn't feel that way right now. I think it's a tough thing to talk about, because it's hard to make too uplifting of a speech about it. I think most about the climate movement, because I write about climate change for the most part. So that's the place I feel best criticizing. And over the last year, over the last 2 years, really, the sort of climate, I won't say movement, but the climate world broadly, and particularly sort of larger well-funded organizations, the Environmental Defense Fund, the Natural Resources Defense Council, they endorsed Biden in, I believe, June 2023, but started sort of as soon as the Inflation Reduction Act passed, did almost nothing else than praise it, right? Had no sort of oppositional program, even the sort of people who said, you know, we love the Inflation Reduction Act, we're very excited about it, would also say that it's not enough, right? That we need to do other sort of things to invest in energy in ways that go beyond that measure, take proactive measures to wind down fossil fuels, figure out what a just transition looks like, invest in adaptation, which is nowhere to be found, look anywhere outside of the US, right? That was sort of mainstream talking points. And much of the climate world just ignored that for a while. And I think one of the more horrifying things in the last year were silent on anything happening in Gaza, right? And that's not to say that everyone needs to make some statement as a matter of course, but to not see sort of basic connections between a government that will allow, you know, many, many, many people to be slaughtered and sort of how they relate to a century in which people will be killed by ever worsening storms and floods, both in our own country and the rest of the world, is a glaring omission. So, you know, I think I think the climate movement, which again, I am sticking to that a little bit just because I think that's what I can really talk about, has a lot of thinking to do. And on the sort of like climate left side as well, I don't know if anyone really figured out what mobilizing after the Inflation Reduction Act looks like. Even sort of the Sunrise Movement, sort of other groups that have, you know, say all the right things, are on the right side. I don't question their motives in any way at all, but I don't think anybody really figured out what it looks like to build a climate movement when that's the law of the land, when it will be virtually impossible to pass legislation for a long time. And, you know, I think something that this election should prompt us to think about is a much closer attention to cost of living issues and drawing connections between housing in particular, right? There's a lot of work to be done, both retrofitting sort of our bad housing stock in much of the country, building sort of affordable social housing that can be green, that can sort of reduce the egregious level of car dependency that exists in the United States. There are these sort of cross-sectoral solutions, for lack of a better phrase, that could allow a climate movement to speak to the sort of cost of living issues that were at the forefront of this election. But I don't think anybody's figured out. We have not fully made the transition from what I see as like the sort of net zero heyday of 2021, when every company and government and so on were making their kind of flowery commitments to say we'll get to, you know, net zero something by sometime and calling it a day. That has not fully, you know, entered a new stage. I think we're in a really weird, sort of hate the word interregnum, but we're in a really weird place for figuring out what that looks like. And as I said, I think the Green New Deal in some ways offers a picture of what organizing for climate under Trump administration could look like, in that the sort of groups that were most active in pushing that, mainly the Sunrise Movement, did not get too distracted by trying to respond to every little thing that Trump did, and also did not take the sort of liberal route of saying the cities will do it, the states will do it, the corporations will do it, right? Did not say, you know, we've got this, it's fine. But really took time. I mean, took like the better part of a year off to figure out what it would look like to mobilize young people around climate. And so I think not getting too distracted by, what will be just a chaotic time, as it was during the last administration, but I think really taking some time to not run the Green New Deal playbook back. It didn't work, obviously, right? And that's not to say that I don't think the Green New Deal can work, or that's not the sort of kind of solution we need, but obviously we're here, right? We're here on the other end of a Trump election in which he won, and we are not that much closer to getting climate policy. And so I think really taking some time to ingest this, and, you know, I don't have the answers to what like the outcome of that will be, but I think really seriously taking a beat and not sort of getting caught in the trap of just like jumping into rapid response to whatever it is, whatever heinous thing that Trump does, you know, including like Robert F. Kennedy taking fluoride out of our water, which could happen. So yeah, I think, you know, taking a beat back and really sort of trying to parse out what did not just we get wrong, but what do, you know, in the climate movement, but what is sort of a reasonable path forward that like looks fundamentally different than what we've been doing for the last 10 years, which has been more of the same.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to open the floor for questions now. So if you're online, you can just type questions into the Q&A box and we'll try to answer them. And please, if possible, include your name and affiliation. And if you're here, just raise your hand and wait for the microphone. And again, if you could provide your name and affiliation. And I think it's okay if you want to make a short comment rather than a question. You don't have to apologize, but just keep it short. Let's work on the art of brevity. So I see one hand here in, I see two hands here in the front. Why don't we take two questions at once, and maybe we can get some quick responses, and we can go around. So. Yeah. All right, you can, whatever. Yeah.
I'm Tasneem. I'm 17. I'm just here for personal interest. So I've heard whispers from sources closest to, you know, U.S. government and stuff, saying that important leaders like Pelosi or Obama were pushing for an open convention after Biden dropped out. And what I'm wondering is, do you think that an open convention would have led to a more favorable outcome, and does it really matter?
Great. Here, why don't we take another question, and we can hear it, and we'll just pass it.
Thank you. Ivan Glenda, work as a corporate strategy for a consultancy firm. First of all, thank you very much for your remarks. There's so many questions that you can ask nowadays about US politics and after the elections, but in a year so important because we've seen lots of elections in the world. A few days after January 6th, Biden, during his inauguration, said, "Democracy has prevailed." After these years of elections, and I'm going to steal a title of one of the future events here at LSE, what's the state of democracy after this year, and how the left can capitalize on that? Thank you.
Great. Okay, so we've got open convention and the state of democracy. Who wants to take either of these questions?
I'm open convention, I don't really care. State of democracy, I think even when we talk about democracy and in regard to the United States, for example, I think democracy is probably too strong a word. There are many democratic features, but it's basically an oligarchical system with many democratic features. And if you look at, you know, a lot of academic studies have been done which look at public opinion and political decision making by governments, hardly anything governments do actually is reflected in what public opinion really wants. So that is to say that democracy wasn't in particularly good shape already. It was already pretty oligarchical. And I think probably the biggest change, it seems to be, is that something that Peter Thiel, who's the J.D. Vance's mentor, said something along the lines that the relationship between freedom and democracy, or freedom and capitalism, has collapsed. And I think what he meant by that is that basically big business corporations and others no longer feel a connection with even ordinary constitutional norms. And that's what you see them doing. They're kowtowing to Donald Trump. Jeff Bezos stopped the Washington Post from endorsing any candidate. So did the owner of the LA Times. What they said about after January the 6th, 2021, lock him up. You know, nobody's above the law, and you can expand that to many, many corporations and so on. They leaned in, they said, we're no longer going to support election deniers and so on. So I'd say the state of democracy was in pretty bad shape already. I think it's in much, much worse shape. But the key thing is that if you focus democracy around just constitutional norms and political parties and the judicial system and the legislature and so on, you're effectively looking at elite politics. And that elite politics, divided between the two parties, is a corporate elite politics. It responds to those agendas because they're the people who largely pay. So that, in a way, American, my personal tutor at LSE way back in the old days was Leslie Sclair. He said, American democracy fails by default because of the power of the big corporations and so on. The vigilance of ordinary people, he said, is the only thing which is really kind of a, can not guarantee, but certainly push that elite system which claims to respond to degree to democracy into any kind of progressive direction. That's why the 1960s, with that mass uprisings of so many people, was so much healthier in regard to the United States democracy than anything we've seen since then.
Unless someone has a very quick response to the open convention question.
I know a little bit about it just from reporting, but I don't think it would have made much of a difference, unfortunately. I mean, I think that's the problem with this election, is that the problems are structural in the Democratic Party and go back, you know, decades, and I think it would have helped, certainly, and maybe it would have had a better outcome, but it's hard, given what happened on Tuesday, to feel too optimistic about, you know, who would have done better.
I think that's probably right. Other questions? I see one person in the brown jacket in the aisle, and then you could pass the mic to student, two people over in that same row.
Oh, good evening. I want to first thank the panel for your time. You all made incredible points. Oh, by the way, my name is Christopher Pierre. I am a Master of Law student in International Law at SOAS. But one key issue with this election that was not discussed was the amount of misinformation and disinformation, particularly from foreign adversaries. U.S. intelligence said that this election particularly was had the most interference. Voters did not go into the voting booth last week based upon facts and information. It was based on emotion, spurred by propaganda. The left has no equivalent to the myriad of news sources and Fox News that creates propaganda, information about Kamala Harris's race, or immigrants of color eating pets. I mean, my question is this: how can the left move forward when we live in a world where there's so much misinformation and disinformation, and that can actually get true issues out and make them effective?
Great, thank you. And you can just pass, there's another question right there in the same row, or wherever.
Yeah, hello, my name is Kirill, I'm doing global politics, master program on global politics. Actually, I have like one small question for Professor Palmer. I really want to know what you would prefer Biden to do. Not promising. You criticize that he promised peaceful transfer of power. Like what should he have he done? Should he refuse to give peaceful transfer of power to Trump? And the second question, in general, there is a great educational divide, I think, in America right now, and it worsened. So we are here at one of the greatest higher education institutions in the world, discussing what's wrong. So maybe something is wrong with, it's more of a comment, but I really want to hear a reaction. Maybe something is wrong that we don't understand something about people, and because like educated people voted for Harris, they didn't vote for Trump mostly, but still the majority of Americans voted for Trump. So maybe we missed something, and maybe we don't understand something about what people, ordinary people, need or think. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so we've got misinformation, what should Biden have done, and are we the bad guys?
Just quickly on misinformation, I mean, it's a serious problem. I would just like to know when the elections in the United States were ever held on the basis of truth and facts. Did they tell you the truth about the Iraq War? Did they tell you the truth about the financial system? Did they ever inform you of anything? The whole point about elections in the US is they're based on the bipartisan principle of keep them in the dark and feed them shit. Second point, disinformation is a real problem, but why do people want to believe it? If I choose to adopt a belief, say, for example, that the wildfires ripping through Oregon were set by Antifa arsonists, with no evidence for this belief whatsoever, or if I choose to believe that there is that trans people are actually bathroom predators who pose a threat to our children, and I hallucinate these wild, weird, erotic fantasies with no evidence whatsoever, what does that say about me and my investment? I don't think it's enough to talk about disinformation. Millions of people want this stuff. They want to live in a hallucinated world. And also, last and final point on that, we should not underestimate the important role of political fantasy, right? Political fantasy is what's structuring all this stuff. We've had fantasies of Pizzagate, if you remember. It was a pizza parlor that was supposedly, what was it, child trafficking that was done by Hillary Clinton. You know, all that sort of stuff. I mean, I remember in this country we used to have that Diana was murdered by the secret state, by the Queen or whatever, you know, this kind of thing. And among TikTok users, young TikTok users, I believe they think that Helen Keller wasn't real. It's a theory. You dismiss it and you haven't even looked into the evidence. All right. But my point is that if you look at these fantasies, frequently they, I mean, what all fantasy does is it shapes and directs desire. And often dreams have a way of coming true, though not really in the way that you expect. QAnon's predictions, I mean, if you look at them rationally, they've never come true. Their predictions never come true. And there's a theory that, oh, well, you know, sunk investment theory, people double down on, you know, false beliefs once they're disproved because they've invested too much. Not really the case, as far as I can tell. Empirically refuted. But what is true is that regardless of whether or not the prophecies came true, they have shaped a fundamental and important reality in that they contributed to the first ever attempted insurrection in the Capitol building, where there were men running around with guns who were looking for Nancy Pelosi and AOC to murder and hang and string up if they could. So this, the disinformation, the point of it is not that it's untrue and all the rest of it, of course it is. The point of it is that it's put out there to harness wayward, vengeful impulses that people have, and to give them a focus. And Duterte does it, or did it when he was in power. Bolsonaro had an office of hate. They know what they're doing. It's about organizing rhythmic, it's about imposing rhythm on public emotions and organizing rhythmic pulsions of hate. And it's those desires and those fantasies that I think we have to address. Though, of course, if you can think of a way to stop disinformation, why not?
Any quick answers on what Biden should do or on the other?
I was going to talk about misinformation
go,
a little bit.
Okay, go for it.
I mean, I'll just a very brief point that you know, social media obviously has completely revolutionized political communication, including in elections, but regulation has not kept up with that. So, for example, if you're a part of the mainstream media, which is often criticized, you still have a lot of constraints which do not apply to social media. Just to give you one example, I was following the trial of Tommy Robinson the other week, and Tommy Robinson was a far-right agitator, had sort of drifted to obscurity in British politics until his account on, as then Twitter, now X, was restored. The judge in his trial sentenced him to 18 months in prison and said, but I'm going to reduce your sentence by 4 months if you take down your libelous video. Now, of course, if an established news organisation was publishing a libelous video, we would be taken to court and we'd be, you know, quite correctly part of the legal process. That video is still on X. It's had 60 million views or so forth. And I think that is a real issue that the government can try and or should try to address. So more regulation of the social media world to bring it up to speed with the realities that other news organisations have to deal with.
Great. Just very quickly, does anyone have a response to what should Biden have done, and are we in our educated bubble the problem?
Yeah, just briefly on the educational divide, for something I wrote this week was looking into some of this talk about the manosphere and sort of the, you know, Andrew Tate, Theo Vaughn, Joe Rogan sphere. And some of the data on young men in the United States is really just devastating. One in four young men under the age of 30 who are unmarried say they don't have friends. Young men spend on average an hour more time alone than women of the same age. Across the board, labor force participation is down. There is a real social crisis happening among young men, and many of those men are not college educated. And you know, I think college in the United States is a really bad deal. Honestly, it's really expensive. You don't get much for it. It is, you know, arguably kind of stupid to do what I did and sign up for $40,000 of debt when you're 18 years old. And so for good reason, people aren't going to college, which I don't, you know, I this is a little off the cuff, so I'm not like speaking with as if I've looked at all the data on this. But I do think there are types of socialization which people just don't get. And I think it is a part of the educational divide conversation. And so on the one hand, people going to college, right, that is a valuable sort of social experience. On the other, people who didn't go to college historically have had other kinds of social institutions to have friends, to have social networks that go beyond their immediate family or just themselves, including unions, right? The unions were historically the sort of biggest way to organize men who, you know, were not going to college. And still, the sort of number one professions, the top professions that men who don't go to college work in, are places where union membership has declined. It's things like shipping, it's things like you know, types of manufacturing, places where unions have been systematically dismantled. And so I, you know, don't really have such strong feelings on the educational debate per se, but I think the fact that America is such a deeply lonely and alienated country speaks to why those divides are so profound in the ways that they are.
And in 20 seconds, Indrajit, what would you have preferred Biden to do?
I'm not surprised that he did what he did and said what he said, and it goes to the heart of the issue about liberalism and democracy and the relationship between the two. There's a deep skepticism from the very beginning in liberalism about democracy itself. The ordinary people are seen as kind of ignorant, irrational, and a mob, and that has not generally changed. It's translated into a kind of politics which is very elite-oriented politics, institutional politics, and so on. And what it basically means is that liberalism, liberals, establishment liberals, have a deep skepticism about ordinary people being active and mobilized. And what really a democratic leader would be mobilizing people to say, not that Trump shouldn't take power because he won the election, but that the people should be mobilized and prepared because there's going to be a massive onslaught against the ordinary people's rights, and that the Democratic Party as a party should not be only just for elections, but actually should be key part of the mobilization of that. That's what a Democratic Party, with a smaller D, would really do. But by talking about bipartisanship, a strong Republican Party, well, they got it. Mission accomplished. They got a very strong Republican Party, stronger than the Democratic Party itself. So I think that's a massive problem for them. So that's what I...
Yeah, well, we're going to have to leave it there. So I just want to thank all the speakers, thank the organizers, and thank all of you for coming out tonight.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.